The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's Halef. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. Happy New Year, my dear listeners! We are ringing in the new year with stories of friendship and family. And, of course, when you combine friendship and family, you get siblings. Whether you are a sibling, you always wanted to have a sibling, or if you know someone who is like a sibling to you, our stories are award-winning, humorous, magical, and, yes, tall tales of the special bonds between siblings. Our first story is about siblings having each other's back, no matter the direction they're facing. From the book Sisters, Bonded by Love and Laughter, edited by Marcia Stewart and Terry Rizvi, copyright 2021, the story Lost in the Labyrinth of Life by Lee Gayton, Nikki's Prize for Humor Writing winner. Husbands come and go. Children come and eventually they go. Friends grow up and move away. But the one thing that's never lost is your sister. Gail Sheehy. My older sister was a study in contrasts, an enormously talented woman who had not one practical bone in her body. She created extraordinary artwork and crafted inspired verse, but had to call me to ask the time because she didn't own a clock. Her IQ was high enough to boil water, yet she became hopelessly lost trying to navigate what she called the labyrinth of daily life. The fine print of service contracts and pay-by dates made her head spin. Still, nothing left her so lost, literally lost, as her inability to comprehend directions. These were the days before GPS or smartphones, and the struggle was real. It didn't help that she rejected the concept of cardinal directions out of hand. "What is this true north people talk about?" she asked dismissively. "In Mexico, they say the U.S. is north, but in Canada, they say it's south. It's nonsensical." There was no use trying to explain the difference between cardinal directions and relative locations to her, because her mind was made up. I conceded defeat the day she called to ask me how to get back to her house after an appointment. I started by saying, "Take 85 South." "What?" she cried, interrupting me. "What are you talking about? There is no 85 South. There is only 85 North. I have lived in Atlanta for 20 years, and not once have I ever heard anything about 85 South. It doesn't exist." "Okay," I said, using the same measured tone hostage negotiators use. "It does exist. Think of it this way. You took 85 North to get there, so what will it be when you turn around to go home?" "The other way, obviously," she exclaimed in exasperation. Insert head slap. From then on, I used the navigation by landmark system with her. "You know that house with the metal sheep in the yard? Okay, turn right at the third sheep. You know, the one with the big horns, the ram. And yes, I'm aware of your issues with Capricorns, but they're fairly benign as landmarks. Anyway, go straight, like you're going to the art supply store, but don't stop there. Keep going." Failing to follow the landmark method could result in disaster, such as the narrowly averted wrong-way 285 incident. I-285 is the loop that encircles the city of Atlanta. I had driven to my sister's house one afternoon, and from there we were to meet her friend at a new restaurant. My sister assured me she understood the non-landmark directions her friend had dictated. "We get on 285 and go two exits. Turn right, and it's 1 mile on the left," she explained, her voice full of directional pride. "Good, but which way on 285?" I asked as we walked to my car. With eyebrows arched, she said, "Oh, trying to trick me, huh? Well, ha, ha, it doesn't matter which way we go, because I know 285 is a circle." She smugly stuck her tongue out at me. Insert second head slap. I immediately called her friend to get the full directions and spent the ride explaining that, although 285 was a circle, it was a 64-mile-long circle, so it kind of did matter which way we went. But for my money, her biggest wrong turn in Atlanta was the one that resulted in the complete and unprecedented disappearance of U.S. Highway 78. My sister and I lived 20 miles apart, and the route between our homes was a virtual straight shot. About all she had to do was go straight and turn once. After a few false starts, she mastered it and made the trip several times without incident, until that one fateful night. My daughter's first high school chorus concert was a big production. My daughter, a lowly freshman with the voice of an angel, but the disposition of a teenager, had a solo. She was both thrilled and terrified. The evening of the concert, my sister was to be at my house by 6:30, as my daughter needed to report to school by 7 o'clock. When my sister failed to show by 6:45, my daughter started throwing a fit. So I sent her ahead with her father, and I stayed behind to wait for my sister. I waited and waited and waited. At 7:20, I had no choice but to leave. Just as I was going out the door, the phone rang, and it was my sister. "Where are you?" I cried. "Back home," she replied, breathless and near tears. "What happened?" I asked, panicked. "I tried to come, but 78 is gone. It isn't there anymore. The whole highway has disappeared," she exclaimed. While I thought it rather unlikely an entire highway had disappeared into thin air, I had no time to argue about it then. I hung up and raced to the concert. I had to stand in the back, but at least I didn't miss my daughter's solo. Later, I figured out my sister had stopped for gas and exited the station on the opposite side, which led to an access road instead of directly onto the highway. Hence, the highway's disappearance. Final head slap. Nowadays, recalling these stories brings both laughter and tears, because my sister and I are separated by much more than 20 miles. Even so, there are times I feel her unmistakable presence. I'll think of her and a heart-shaped leaf will suddenly fall in my path, or her favorite song will immediately come on the radio, and I'll know she is near. I take comfort in believing her spirit soars free now, no landmarks required. I know when my spirit prepares to leave this earth, she will be there waiting, and then it will be her turn to show me the way to go. In all seriousness, Lee's feelings toward her sister. My late sister believed she was a fairy, and she sprinkled fairy dust over every corner of my life. She taught me about art, literature, boys, and makeup, and once accidentally shaved off my eyebrows, but insisted it was a good look. She was moon glow and stardust and all things magical, and I'd shave off my own eyebrows to bring her back. In our next story, we learn about how powerful being a sibling can be, sometimes literally. Also from the book, Sisters, Bonded by Love and Laughter, Yes, I Magicked My Sister into the World, by Caitlin Drulis. Beware the Power of Plastic Babies. I knew my mom wanted a boy. I also knew I wanted nothing to do with some truck-loving little brother. Despite being 7 and having no idea of how babies were made, I had to take action, to do something to make my dream of a sister come to life. Thanks to my love of fairy tales, I was well educated on how magic could be used to make dreams come true. Unfortunately for my parents, my magical methods seemed to be derived more from the occult than fairy tales. My first attempt was to glue plastic babies onto a belt for my mom to wear, a long, sticky line of oversized heads and little arms and legs reaching toward the world. Creepy, but it had to be effective, right? I moved on to setting the table for 4 people, including 1 empty chair for my future sister. I insisted that my parents drink out of her water glass and watched carefully to make sure they really swallowed. My loving parents played along with my wacky rituals, although I'm pretty sure Mom never wore that baby belt. So, when Chloe arrived, I felt absolutely sure that she was my baby. I never wanted to put her down, which earned me the nickname Baby Hog among my relatives. By the time Chloe was a toddler, it was clear that her personality traits were inspired by some powerful magic. She was energetic, playful, and generous in spirit, enthusiastically going along with my imaginary games and impromptu dance performances. She let me dress her in outfits with enough sparkles and bling to have made Liberace proud. She was my biggest and littlest cheerleader, and by the age of 2 was the designated mascot for my softball team. Later in elementary school, Chloe developed a mischievous streak. Her favorite game was to whisper in a smug yet ominous manner, "Caitlin, I see a spider." As a full-blown arachnophobe, I had no ability to control my reaction, even after the 100th time, and would immediately shriek and flee the entire country if I had to. Chloe then upped the ante by declaring regularly, "Caitlin, spider on your head!" It got so bad that I began to wonder if I'd gotten it wrong with my magic and actually conjured an evil sister instead. Fortunately, she eventually got bored of this game. As adults, our dynamic as sisters evolved into being best friends. Our sense of humor and temperaments are as similar as our shared physical traits. An Uber driver once exclaimed in awe that he'd never driven identical twins before. Being nearly a decade older, I greatly appreciate the mistake, which is made frequently by both strangers and my iPhone recognition software. Every time she unlocks my phone with her face, I'm grateful that Chloe already knows all my secrets. Most of all, my sister's playfulness and wit can make ordinary moments hilarious. I regularly find myself doubled over, laughing at something only the two of us understand. She really is my dream sister. And for our last story, the tallest tale of them all. You guessed it. Award-winning storyteller Bill Lepp regales us with a tribute to his sibling. From his book, Inept, Impaired, Overwhelmed, Tall Tales from West Virginia and Beyond, copyright 2012, the chapter, The Monster Stick's Last Ride. You know you are a real West Virginian when you consider a fishing pole a family heirloom. As some of you know, my brother Paul passed away in January of 98, but many were the times Paul stood on the stage of the Liars Contest and bedazzled us all with stories of the Monster Stick. Now, the Monster Stick was Paul's 9-foot surf-casting rod, complete with 6 miles of brand-new 50-pound test Stren Carp cord. It was the castingest outfit he ever owned, and he always talked about how dangerous the monster stick was in the hands of an amateur. The reason the monster stick was such a hazard to the untrained was mainly because it was such a bear to cast. Casting the monster stick entailed a two-handed, full-body twist that was a cross between an Olympic hammer throw and a ballet pirouette. Casting from shore presented a myriad of problems, and casting from any vessel smaller than an aircraft carrier almost always resulted in the boat being capsized. The monster stick was the Pandora's box of fishing equipment. Strange things happened again and again whenever the monster stick reared its head. Take the time my grandfather was bringing the monster stick to this country. He cast off the deck of a huge cruise liner and snagged what he thought was a whale. He only realized he was mistaken when he brought the thing alongside the ship and the guy in the crow's nest hollered, "Iceberg!" To my grandfather's great embarrassment, that ship sank in something over 2 hours. Needless to say, I was scared stiff of the monster stick. I never went near the thing. But this last April, I was out in my garden tilling when I heard a voice say, "If you bait it, catfish will come." I looked around, but didn't see anybody. And then I heard it again, "If you bait it, catfish will come." Even though I couldn't see anyone talking to me, I could tell from the slow West Virginia drawl that the voice could only belong to one of two people. It was either God or my brother Paul. Either way, the revelation was clear. The monster stick needed one last fling, and I was going to have to be the man to do it. I snuck into my sister-in-law's house and stole the monster stick from its resting place above the mantel. I bought a 5-gallon bucket of raw beef livers and a bass boat, and then I set sail on the waters of the mighty Buchanan River. Standing in that boat with that rod in my hand, I felt as confident and as volatile as a third-world dictator with nuclear capabilities. I was heavily armed, crazy with power, and right likely to do something stupid enough to put all of humanity in jeopardy. To be honest with you, I think the day would have come out just fine if I hadn't made one particular mistake. You see, I decided that I ought to bring my dog, Buck, out in that boat with me. For those of you who don't know, Buck is my super dog, whose mother was a German Shepherd, and whose father was a prolific and extremely determined Basset Hound. Like most of the men in my family, Buck is funny-looking and none too bright. As a matter of fact, when God was passing out brains, Buck thought he said drains, and so he asked for one that emptied quickly. On the other hand, when God was passing out noses, Buck thought he said roses, and so he asked for one that smelled real good. Buck's nose is one of the best in the world. Just to give you an example of his nasal prowess, remember that fairy tale about the princess who sleeps on the 23 mattresses and then finds the one with the pea in it? Well, that's nothing. I guarantee that even if you had 23,000 mattresses, it would take Buck less than a minute to find the one with the princess's pea on it. Anyway, I tossed Buck one whole beef liver to keep him quiet while I was fishing. Then I put another whole liver on the hook at the end of my line. I stood up, closed my eyes, grasped the monster stick in both hands, and went into my cast. As I spun around, I put all my weight on my right foot. That caused the boat to list in that direction, and subsequently pushed all the water on the right side of the river against the right bank. Then I put all my weight on my left foot. That pushed the boat in that direction, and so all the water on the left side of the river was pushed against that shore. With nothing to hold it up any longer, that bass boat plopped down into the muddy bottom of the Buchanan River. When I opened my eyes and saw those two walls of water on either side of me and felt the power of that rod in my hand, I knew just what Moses must have felt like at the Red Sea. When I looked again and saw those two walls of water collapsing on me, well, then I knew just what Pharaoh's army must have felt like. Just before those two walls of water crashed down, I noticed a few things. First, I noticed that the line of the monster stick was still feeding out nicely, and that the bait was rocketing down the river. Then I noticed that there was a strange-looking blob on the end of my hook. The last thing I saw was that Buck Dog was no longer in the boat. As near as I can figure, Buck was jealous that I was going to give a whole liver to the catfish, and so when I cast, he had sprung for the bait and in the process had caught his collar on the hook. I had just cast my dog away worse than the Swiss Family Robinson. Then the water crashed down. The force of that water drove my tiny bass boat 3 feet into the mud and left me mired up to my hips in pure muck. But the line was still spinning out, and I knew I was in trouble. Either Buck was going to drown when he hit the water, or he was going to be swallowed up by a huge catfish. And I didn't want to have to explain all that to my wife. If I was going to save my dog, I was going to have to work fast. I reached in my pocket and pulled out my trusty 74-function Swiss Army-type knife. I quickly opened up the scuba gear and the flippers. I have the Jacques Cousteau special. I had to pay $10 extra for all that. I suited up, pulled myself out of the mud, and headed to shore, towing the monster stick in that 5-gallon bucket of livers. I made it to shore just as Buck started his downward arch. I saw the railroad tracks and heard the whistle blow just as Buck was hitting the water. Now, those weren't just any railroad tracks, mind you, but Weirton's world-famous steel fashioned into CS and X railroad tracks stretching clear from Cowan to Grafton via Burnsville, Buckcannon, Carrollton, and Philippi. And, as luck would have it, just then a 6-engine, 168-car CS and X monster train was rolling by. I made it to the train just as Buck sank beneath the surface of the water. I jammed the monster stick into the rungs of the ladder of the last car on that train and jumped on. Monster stick, meet monster train. For various physical and scientific reasons that I just don't have time to go into here, the momentum of that train going in the opposite direction of that cast was sufficient to pull Buck out of the water and drag him along. Buck got his feet under him and was cruising along like a water skier. He lifted his front paws, did a few rooster tails, and even flipped over a fallen log. All the while, I was reeling away. I got Buck about 10 feet away from the train, just off the edge of the bank, and then I flipped my wrists, and the monster stick popped Buck out of the water. I think everything would have been fine from that point on, if a catfish the size of a Buick hadn't chosen that exact moment to strike for the bait. That catfish came out of the water faster than a White House intern from the Oval Office. The fish swallowed up Buck's hind end. I flipped the bait, Buck, and the catfish out of the water and behind the train where they all plopped down on the tracks. That catfish was so big that he straddled the tracks and was coming along behind the train like a flatboat on the Erie Canal. I had to get Buck out of that fish's mouth, so I took one of those old beef livers and threw it at the fish. I figured that as soon as it got within range, the fish would open its mouth and try to catch it. When the catfish opened his mouth for the liver, I would just reel Buck in. The only thing was, Buck smelled that liver coming, and when it got within range, he leaped up and swallowed it whole. I said, "Bad dog! Bad dog!" and tossed another liver. Buck swallowed that one too, and the next, until my 5-gallon bucket was empty and my 5-gallon buck dog was full. I was at my wit's end. I didn't know what to do. Fortunately, Buck is not totally without means of his own. You see, all that fear and liver started to react with the natural juices inside of Buck, and, to put it politely, Buck's own personal gastrointestinal El Nino went into hyperdrive. He released enough methane into that catfish to put both Mountaineer and Columbia Gas out of business. That catfish swelled up like the Hindenburg and rose up off the tracks. As the fish and Buck shot skyward, I had to play out the line to keep it from breaking. Before long, I had all 6 miles of line reeled out, and Buck and that catfish were trailing behind the train like a kite. Every time we went around a curve, it would fling them way out around the train, and it was everything I could do to hold on. We rounded a particularly sharp curve, and it whipped those two way out to the side. The force was so great, and they were going so fast, that when the 50-pound carp cord hit a mountain about 23 feet from the top, the line just cut right through it like a hot knife through butter. The top of the mountain lifted up and then crashed back down. Well, I smiled then. I mean, if nothing else had gone right that day, at least I had just completed the first and only totally successful mountaintop removal and reclamation operation. I looked over my shoulder and saw that the train was going into a tunnel. I started reeling as fast as I could and had Buck and that giant fish right behind the train again as we hit the tunnel. The bloated catfish slammed into the tunnel entrance and his front lips filled the opening, but no more would fit in. The line on the monster stick started to sing under the pressure, caught, as it was, between the immovable force of the catfish and the unstoppable force of the monster train. At the critical moment, when it seemed sure I would lose Buck forever, the catfish gave up. He parted his lips, and Buck shot out like the cork from a bottle of champagne. The catfish flew backward out of the tunnel and danced around the sky like a deflating balloon until he finally dove back into the river. I grabbed Buck, the monster stick, and the empty liver bucket and jumped from the train. I went straight to my sister-in-law's and hung the monster stick back in its place of honor over the mantel. It had had its last fling, and now may Paul and the monster stick rest in peace. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any humorous quotes or authors you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number, one more time, is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.